Welcome to Chew the Fat. In this series, I sit down with high-performance guests and we talk about life, business, and what it takes to be at the top. This is part of my mission to raise $1 million for charity by writing a cookbook called Eat with Purpose. But I'm going to need your help. If you can share the content and leave a review, it's going to make a massive impact. And the bigger the audience, the greater the reach, and the sooner we can get to that $1 million goal. Enjoy the episode. Luke, so part of the Chew the Fat tradition is I cook for the guest. And so today I got the requirements. You want sunny Italian. So what I've done here is it's almost like a risotto. It's like a little tomato-y. It's called Rossini pasta. And then I'll top a little seared lamb chop.
Thanks, Frank. Looks
no,
great.
No worries.
Let's put it to the test.
Yeah.
This
delicious.
Delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, so I it's always fun when I get to travel and do this. The other day was in Melbourne. No, it was in the Gold Coast. And so I was up at like 4 a.m. Preparing some of the dish.
That was exceptionally good. Thank you.
Luke Anea, founder and CEO of Safety Culture.
Hi, Frank.
Welcome to Chew the Fat.
Thanks very much.
Where I'd love to start is, what's the context of your upbringing that created the entrepreneur you are today?
Good question. I think a lot of support from my mum. She was probably my number one fan. And growing up with no money, I think helps. Constraints and imperatives, I think, drive innovation. And we had plenty of constraints and a fair few imperatives. So, yeah, I think when I was young, I thought, wow, if we could have some money, then we would be happier.
Yeah.
But I learned pretty quickly. You know, by the time I was 17, 18, I was earning 120 grand a year in my own place and was lonely and thought, hang on a minute, money's not the answer. Must be something else to this equation that I'm missing. So... it's been a bit of a journey, but initially I thought, you know, I need to understand business.
Mm.
But then once I sort of got my head around that, then it was more about doing something that actually makes a positive difference in the world, doing more for other people rather than trying to just serve yourself. And once I think I figured that out, that's when things got it much easier.
Love that. And for those who don't know, what is Safety Culture? And what is that positive impact on the world that you're creating?
Yeah, so I used to be a private investigator, spy on people for the insurance companies when they got injured at work. And so Safety Culture was created to help people do their best work every day. So we have a platform. It started with a checklist app, which is the world's most used checklist app. So whenever a plane would take off or a hotel room gets cleaned or something, there's a good chance Safety Culture was involved. And so that became, I guess, you know, the old saying, sort of do one thing well before you do anything else. That was the one thing, I guess, we did well. And today, you know, we're an operations platform, which basically just means we help companies do what they do better with their teams that they train and report issues and get information to the right people at the right time and take data off assets and all those sorts of things. But essentially, we just help teams improve what they do every day.
And I promised you we wouldn't get too deep into the story today because, of course, you have that awesome series on Amazon, which you self-funded, called Founder. But there's one story I'd love for those who may not have heard it. And we touched on it around the day you got a phone call from the pilot or the...
airline in South America.
Yes. Tell us more.
Well, Al had put an update out. We were still in the garage in Townsville at this point and on acreage in the northern suburbs of Townsville. And Al had put an update out. And one of the things you could do with our app was take photos of an aircraft or things like that. And so the update had broken the report builder that takes all the photos and all the answers to the questions and turns it into a PDF. And that was no longer working. And so that was at 5 p.m. on a Friday, did the update. So the first thing I'd recommend is you don't push out updates at 5 o'clock Friday because it means you might be back Friday night. But by about 8 or 9 p.m., we had this email from an airline saying, we, you know, love your app. We use it to inspect all our aircraft, which we never intended, you know, thought that someone would do that. But because they couldn't get a report off, they couldn't then pass that on to the regulators as part of their auditing. So they're like, we could get grounded if someone comes to check on this. And so, you know, I'm ringing Al back saying, mate, good news is we've got some airline in South America that's using us. The bad news is you've broken the report builder and we've got to fix it, otherwise they may not be able to fly. So I think that was the moment where we kind of went, holy shit, like this is real. People are actually relying on this thing we built. And, you know, then we'd have someone lose their device and say, where's this backed up to? And we'd be like, it's not backed up anywhere. And so we had to build a cloud. And, you know, those early days, it was all very much a baptism of fire for us.
And what were those you know, as you talk about that, the sense I get is there was perhaps when you first launched, you didn't quite realize there's the severity of something like an airline utilizing this. Was there a lot of learnings along the way that you started to realize, okay, it needs to be up all the time in order to, you know, work at this particular scale? Like, what were some of those learning lessons?
Yeah, scaling is the key. Like, you know, to be able to build an app for 100 people to use is probably pretty easy. To build an app for 100 million people to use is a whole nother set of complexities that you have to manage. And so you need to be able to build it so that it's not going to break. And, you know, as more people start using it, you've got to make sure that they still get an experience that's going to allow them to want to come back. If things start slowing down, which, you know, we had customers, you know, building checklists that had, some of them had up to 45,000 questions in a checklist, all logic driven. Yeah, exactly. It was, you know, Department of Homeland Security in the US, and they were like, we're using this to check a whole bunch of stuff, and they would only ever see a few questions at a time, but the memory management on the devices was insane. And so they're contacting us saying, hey, our devices are slowing down. They're getting a bit clunky. And when we'd have a look and see what they're doing, we're like, well, no wonder. Like, so there's a lot of work that Al did early on as well to just, you know, sort out the memory management on the device and how we were handling information. So those sort of complexities come in when you start getting lots of people doing, you know, things that you never imagined with your products.
Yeah, there's only so much user testing you can do. You probably would never think there's going to be 45,000 questions and logic.
We had another thing where you could preview a template when you build it. So if you build an inspection template for a 737 or something, you could preview it and actually do like a dummy check. But we had this customer in New York that kept losing all their data, and we just could not replicate it. So we ended up flying over there. And what he was doing was going into preview mode and then doing his actual checks. And then at the end of it, it would disappear. And so it was a user experience issue from our point of view. We shouldn't have made it, you know, I guess, as like so not so obvious that that's what was happening. So, you know, that sort of stuff, you just got to figure out as you go.
And I'd love to, from what you can talk about around the scale, so that everybody can get a sense of safety culture as it is today, you know, number of team members, number of users, all of that, so we can really contextualize as we dive into, you know, I guess the lessons for the audience.
So we serve about 75,000 companies around the world.
Wow.
We don't have any external salespeople, mm-hmm. so that's all been inbound. So pretty much every company you could think of would probably use us in some way, but most of them don't use us across the board because we've never gone and sold it to them where the management team roll it out. So it's frontline workers who have been picking it up and using it and drive it. So they become our salespeople. That's kind of our secret sauce.
Wow.
Is our sort of frontline customers got recognition for rolling out safety culture, and then they get promoted and get to do it more. So that's kind of how the business is actually built.
Wow.
And the team itself, our team's about 750 odd people today. I think we're hiring 200 at the moment, 200 more. And really starting to ramp things up again after a couple of years where the markets have all been pretty flat, and we've just sort of consolidated for a while. So it's very much a case now of back to build mode and grow as fast as we can. And it's used, our platform's used to do all sorts of stuff, from United Nations that check security points that they set up in Afghanistan or somewhere, to SpaceX checking stuff on the ground, or Tesla, or Rolls-Royce building aircraft engines, or Mitsubishi doing airbag recalls and having to get every dealership in the world to go and fit new airbags to all their cars that are being recalled. They can roll us out in like 2 weeks, and all of a sudden they've got a way of being able to document what's been done and making sure it's all done appropriately. So all sorts of stuff like that. We have an insurance business now where we underwrite the risk as well for our customers. So we workers' comp and business pack insurance, all that sort of thing. If we're helping them run a better business, then it makes sense. We can also price the risk for them accurately and take care of them if there's a problem. So we have our own claims team, our own claims license, all that sort of stuff. We also sell 70,000 products in the workplace for wearables. So all your 3M range and Honeywell and things like that, clothing and stuff. Workers can just have one-click ordering on their phones based on a budget that's set up for their team, and then they just have a couple of people that approve it just with a Tinder-style swipe, and then it rocks up next day on their job site. So we're about to take that from 70,000 products to 1 million products this year. And then it'll go to 5 million over the next 3 years. So pretty much it's like the Amazon for the workplace. So that's just one part of our business.
Wow.
But we're doing a bit, and we're in, you know, most countries around the world in one form or another.
So, okay, there's so many questions that are boiling into my mind today. I wrote some notes, but I'm going rogue here because it is crazy the scale. So I want to take a step back here. This is big in terms of scale and as well as thinking in terms of these different strategic points. How much of this can you boil down to? How many years ago was it that you launched?
We launched the app 2012, so 12 years ago this year.
12 years ago. So incredible pace as well to get to where you are. Like, how much of this was big thinking was ingrained in you as a founder 12 years ago to get you to now?
It evolves for sure. The opportunities got bigger for us over time. And our ability to be able to build good products that customers want has improved as well. So, you know, I think I had a vision at the start that we would kind of, I guess, help teams manage their safety, and that's why the company is called Safety Culture. But it very quickly grew into improvement and quality and just general stuff. Like, you know, a core hotel, for example, they might use us to even assess, was a customer offered a glass of water when they arrived? Were they given a map of the facility? Were they shown to their room? Like, this is all customer experience stuff, nothing to do with safety. And so a big part of our business is that, and that's kind of evolved. So from the beginning, could I see it all as it is today? No, but our product roadmap is actually still pretty well the same as it was then, and we're still building that out. So the actual detail and how it would look and feel and all that, we probably couldn't see. But in terms of the overall value proposition, then I had a fair sense of that from the beginning.
Incredible. And one of those things stood out to me is around this, you know, as the business scales and you have these big moments, you know, we only have so many bullets, you know, i.e. time and resources to make the right bets. Like, how do you go, what's your process when it comes to like strategic decisions around the next right, you know, vertical or ancillary to, you know, go to your customer base?
Yeah, I think about, does it accelerate our roadmap? So what we're trying to do, is it going to help us get there quicker? Or is it a distraction? So, you know, being very focused around the outcome and what we're going after.
How do you measure that? So is it, you know, what's the, I guess I'm trying to boil down for that audience to be like, you know, very different scale, but many different little opportunities come. It's like helping someone to go, taking that next right move.
I think, you know, intuition plays a big part. You got to say no to many, many good things so that you can say yes to the few great things. And as you, I guess, get further along, more good things get thrown your way. You know, more people have, you know, a business that maybe you should buy and all this kind of stuff. And so there's the distractions increase. And so the discipline and the focus required has to increase as you go. And so I think, you know, does this feel right, you know, in terms of, is it something that is sustainable? You know, from a customer point of view, is this going to create a step change for them, or is it just going to be incremental?
Yeah.
Incremental improvements are okay, but you've got to look for the step changes, the paradigm shifts. And if you just keep incrementally improving, you'll get a fair way. But if you can then look for step changes on top of that, then you can compound that and it really makes a big difference. So we think about, you know, how far ahead does this take us? Your customer will tell you what's wrong with your current product, but they won't tell you the next product you should make. So you kind of have to be listening to customers, and I still get every support ticket. You know, there's tens of thousands a month that goes in my inbox. I read a few every couple of weeks just to see what customers are saying and where they're at. And so you take all that feedback on board, but then you've got to go and augment that with, I guess, a different way of thinking about, you know, what the future looks like, what doesn't exist today that needs to exist 2-5 years from now. And somehow in the middle of all that, you end up making a decision on what you should do. And usually most things we decide we get wrong. And then you get a few right, and that makes up for all the wrong ones. So I think, you know, making a decision is more important than trying to make the right decision.
Love that. I want to tease out one thing there, which is around the making wrong decision. Can you bring me to, was there, you know, in the last 12 years, was there any big scale decisions or big scale plays that you made that made a material negative impact?
Gee, there'd be lots of little ones. I don't know about too many big ones that we got wrong. I'm sure they're there. Like, I know prior to the checklist app being released, I tried a bunch of stuff that didn't work. You know, I built a training platform and that didn't take off. I built a document management portal for companies to manage all their documents and that didn't go anywhere. Like, there's a litany of things that didn't work. But I think, now as the teams have grown, there are things that we've built that probably haven't got the traction that you mm-hmm. would have hoped. And we come back and revisit them and look at that. We tried to build our own training platform mm-hmm. The second time around. And we spent 2 years on that with the team. And then we ended up acquiring EdApp, which then mm-hmm. became our SC training product. So there's plenty of examples yeah. where it doesn't work out as you'd expect. But I think the key thing is consistency, turning up every day. Mm. You know, commitment is what's needed to start, but consistency is what you need to finish. And so if all you do is keep turning up and figuring it out, then usually you'll work it out.
And I think that's really important for the people listening is, you know, you could quickly rattle off a few of those, air quotes, failures. But the reality is, like, as I see you talk, I can see those have had almost net zero implications to your mindset, because it's very much like, it's about the next. It's about consistently showing up. And then over time, it compounds to create what it is you have today, which is very impressive.
Yeah, I think we learn very little from our success. Mm. We learn the most from our failures. And, you know, when the team wins, everyone goes in and high-fives each other and celebrates. When they lose, they all walk in and go, where do we go wrong? Mm. And so I think we learn everything from failure. And I don't think being scared of failure is something that we've ever really adopted. It's always been expected that most things you try are probably not going to work that great. Being able to dust yourself off and get back up and going again tomorrow is what matters, because it's inevitable that a lot of what you do is not going to work. And I think you often see that with people who get given a lot of like money or things like that. Sometimes they grow up with it. They have never developed the discipline of having to constantly fail and keep getting up again. And that is a disadvantage for a lot of people, because once you have that resilience, then you can take on more risk, you can try more things, you can help other people, which is really how you scale a business. You've got to do it through other people. So then you can help other people take risks and fail and get back up again and understand that that's part of the process. It doesn't mean it's the end of the process. And so, yeah, that's all part of, I guess, figuring it out.
Mm. And what about yourself as an individual? So the requirements that the safety culture business 12 years ago had on on Luke look very different to what they are today. How have you managed to stay ahead of that curve personally to make sure that you're, equally, if not way more valuable to the organisation as you once were when you founded it?
Well, you assume that I'm staying ahead of the curve. sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm falling behind and playing catch-up. So Scott Farquhar said to me in the beginning when he invested through Blackbird that the hardest part of this whole thing will be for you to grow personally at the rate of the opportunity. And I can vouch for that being true. It definitely is. And so, there's some practical things that I've had to learn how to do, but then just I think emotionally being able to deal with the pressure, the expectation, the setbacks, all of that takes its toll. And so I think, and luckily I've friends with the other sort of founders in Australia, I guess, that are sort of on a similar journey, and we all kind of share those experiences. But there's a few skills, like being able to switch context from one meeting to the other. In one moment you might be with a staff member that's just had their parents die, and then you go into another meeting, it might be with an investor, then you go to another meeting, it might be with a customer. They're three very different headspaces, and you need to be able to be fully present and not carry the last one into the next one. And so I think early on, you'd have something happen or someone didn't work out in a role, and you feel the weight of that, and you drag it around with you for a week. You just can't do that. So you need to be able to see things for what they are. I guess check in with your sort of, sense of right or wrong, or how to deal with things, how to make decisions, and then move forward. And you can't really dwell on things too much. So that takes time. The other thing is just managing people. I think every junior manager wants to be liked. You want people to like you as a person. And if they don't like you, you feel bad.
That's actually really interesting. Do you know what else is interesting? the Eat With Purpose cookbook. It's part of my mission to raise $1 million for charity. This podcast is part of that goal, and what you can do is like, comment, share, and leave us a review. Let's get back to the guest.
And I think that kind of liked or not liked binary approach to managing teams and leading teams, it's really hard to sustain, and it's just impossible to achieve, actually. You're never going to be liked by everyone. And so I think learning how to support people, you know, to give them the best opportunity to do their best work. Like, that's my role, is to give them that, provide some accountability and a structure around it, and then support them to do it, challenge them positively, but not necessarily always be liked. If they go home some days because, you know, they don't feel great about something I've told them or feedback, then sometimes maybe that's appropriate. And then they have a think about it, and comes back to winning and losing. You know, when you lose, you kind of stop and have a think. And so, I think understanding those sorts of things have helped me develop as time's gone on. But, it's climbing Mount Everest. It's people often say you're having fun. You know, I think if you stopped anyone on the side of Mount Everest in a blizzard with, you know, 60-mile-an-hour winds or something, and they got frostbite and everything else, and someone says, hey, you having fun? Like, you're climbing Mount Everest. How good's that? You're not having fun. No. You're taking on the biggest challenge of your life.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. But, you know, if you're doing it in a way that makes other people's lives better, then it's fulfilling and rewarding. And ironically, you know, sometimes I meet people, particularly younger people, and they're trying to, you know, they want to get wealthy, or they want to get lots of followers on Instagram, or whatever it is that they're going after. If it's driven sort of from self-importance, then it's usually pretty difficult to maintain. And they're always looking for pats on the back and confirmation that they're doing something good and that people like them and, you know, support them, as opposed to just focusing on doing things for other people.
Yeah.
Then the compliments and all those things come disproportionately. The amount of times that, you know, I get someone goes, wow, what you built's amazing, that kind of thing. When I was starting out, you probably just hope that someone said that. You know, now I hear it all the time, and it's great, but it's not what motivates me. I don't do it to get pats on the back. I do it because I think it's worth doing. And that's a sustainable way of operating, as opposed to trying to look for the next bit of recognition.
With regards to the idea as a leader, I really like the concept there. You're talking about supporting people. Practically speaking, what does that look like for you? Like, what? How do you go about best supporting your team to get them to do their best work, as you suggested?
I'll give you an example. Tom, who works with me, he came from banking in New York and stuff, was a lawyer before that, smart guy. He came and said, I want to run our global Internet of Things business. And he got a 20-minute pitch on what he wanted to do. And it just wasn't quite all coming together for me. And so I just randomly drew 7 columns on the whiteboard and just gave them headings, made them up on the spot. I wrote strategy, vision, leadership, ability to confront difficult things, work ethic, EQ, IQ, handed him the pen and said, just rate yourself out of 10 on each of those. And Tom was like, oh, shit. and he, you know, gave himself a 9 for work ethic. I thought, yep, that's fair. He works hard. But like a 5 on strategy. And I thought, okay, let's talk about why. And he said, you know, maybe I just don't always have the most crystal clear ideas and things when it comes to strategy. And I said, okay, so my take is that you're weak on strategy because you haven't built a business. You've seen lots of stuff, but you haven't actually built it and the thinking that's required to build it. So you either need to go somewhere else and build a business, and that's at the risk of losing him, but it's what's best for Tom is what I'm thinking of here,
solid,
not what's best for me. And so either go somewhere else and build a business, or I'll give you a 90-day challenge and you can do it here. What do you want to do? And so he reluctantly took the challenge, and it was, we have $200 fridge sensors that we sell for businesses to monitor their refrigeration of food and things. And I said, how many of these things we sold in the last 12 months, whatever? And we'd sold like $80,000 worth with a few people working on it. It was a tiny sort of business. And so I said, all right, here's the challenge. You got 90 days to sell $100,000 worth of these $200 sensors yourself. So figure out who's going to buy them, how you're going to get logistics to supply them, all this, where they're coming from, all that kind of stuff. Away you go. And so he walked out the door and, you know, he was pretty stressed. He didn't sleep for a bit. And I think his wife wasn't liking me too much. And 3 days in, you know, I checked how he was going. And he said, yeah, well, you know, I think we're coming up with a plan. And he said, I said, what about AdWords and landing pages? Like, you got a Shopify account? Like, how are you doing this? He's like, oh, the marketing team's helping me with some AdWords. I said, marketing team, this is not a team challenge. Yes. You're the team. You're it. You're doing the AdWords. You're doing the landing pages. You're setting up the store. Whatever you got to do, you're figuring out. This is you.
I love this.
And he was like, oh, shit. So he just sunk to a new low.
Yeah.
And anyway, we checked in over the weeks ahead, and he rang me on a Sunday night about 7 p.m., 10 weeks into it. And he said, you know, Goldman Sachs and different places I'd work, I'd never had that kind of experience when you put that up on the whiteboard like that and got me to school myself. And this challenge, he said, I've personally gone and installed like 200 of these things in Hoyt cinemas around Australia and their ice cream fridges and stuff. I know exactly how to do this. And he got pretty emotional. He started crying and said, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Sold $340,000 worth of these sensors in 8 weeks out of this challenge.
No way.
And or 10 weeks out of 12. And today he's a completely different person. How he thinks, he knows. And so he came back with a new strategy on our IoT business, and he runs it today, and it's phenomenal. And the incredible thing is that not only changed Tom's life and the way he thinks, but it changed all the people around him as well. And then other people are like, we want what Tom had.
Yeah.
Where's our challenge? And so, you know, when you talk about supporting people, it's about unlocking their own potential.
Mm.
Most people don't realize what they're capable of until they're challenged in a really positive way. And so I think I'm in a fortunate role today where I get to challenge people in a way that wakes them up.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And that's where it gets rewarding too, because you see other people grow and develop, and it's a cool thing.
Man, I love that story. That is so cool. Take me to the moment at the end of that 10 weeks when you're sitting across from Tom and you get to kind of debrief. Like, how did that feel for you?
I felt happy for him.
Mm.
I felt happy for him because I saw a different person in front of me, and someone that knew what they were here to do and they knew how to do it. And it was just a matter then of making sure he had the resources to go and get it done. And so it's that's pretty satisfying.
That's so cool. Like, yeah. I can see in the way your face and your smile lights up there. It's like that hits home. I think that perfectly contextualizes this idea of supporting people, because it's not linear. It's not here are the exact steps, but it's the right things that person's going to require to get them to that place.
Yeah, I think Craig Tiley, who's on our board, he runs the Australian Open and Tennis Australia CEO, and I think he's the best CEO that I've ever met, and he does that so well with his teams. He challenges them in a great way. They have so many crises that come to the Australian Open, whether it be bushfires and ash raining onto the courts, or you've got the world's best players there breathing it in and complaining about stuff, or you've got, you know, hailstorm that takes out half the vehicles that are used to drive everyone around, or you've got Novak Djokovic that's stuck in immigration while the world's watching, like all these things. But he uses all that as a positive for those teams to be able to really galvanize themselves around a common cause and go after it. And I think he's a very, very good leader and operator, and I take a lot of inspiration from how he does that, which is pretty good. The other piece he does as well, which every great leader has to have, is the vision piece. You've got to be able to set a compelling vision that people want to be part of and go after. And so he's always pushing. If you look what the Australian Open has become from, you know, when he started, it was really the worst of the four major tennis events in the world. And today it's probably one of the best sporting events in the world, and it's phenomenal. And so I think if you've got a great vision and you can articulate it in a way that excites people, then it's about creating challenges for them that are going to bring the best out in them.
So good. And one of the things I'm hearing through the Scott Farquhar investment, knowing that you know the people of founder, this person, is you have some incredible people in your sphere, in your network, and some of them being amazing entrepreneurs. What are the parallels that you're noticing between these different people that you think has created this success?
Wow. You know, it's funny. I don't think there are that many parallels.
Mm.
Because they're all so different. You look at Mel at Canva, or Catherine at Bright, or Fred Chabeska, who you've had on before. These people are all very different people to each other, and yet they share some common traits.
Mm.
They have dreamt big. They've then taken the steps to go after the dream, and they haven't stopped when they've hit setbacks. They're probably the parallels.
Mm.
Everything else is kind of unique to them. You know, I think there's definitely a sense of wanting to, not fail, maybe a fear of failure. That's quite common, things like that. that's all part of the ingredients. But I saw some research recently where founders and their backgrounds were looked at, and a lot of them were had disrupted childhoods and upbringings, different schools, some of them different countries, immigrants, things like that, just got used to change. That, by far and away, it wasn't the Ivy League college graduates that were generally the most common pedigree.
Mm.
It was kind of the people who had really challenging upbringings and environments and learned how to overcome adversity.
Mm.
That seems to be the majority. You know, in Mel's case, you know, she grew up in Perth and her parents, you know, had a pretty humble upbringing, same with Cliff, and those two came together and built Canva.
Mm.
Catherine was, you know, she came from Macquarie Bank, so kind of, you know, I guess middle Australian type lifestyle. They weren't poor, but they also weren't wealthy, and yet she gave up the corporate job and went and started a business, took a risk. And so, you know, I think there are some common traits that are in these founders, but the great thing about this is I think anyone could actually do it. And it's not to say that everyone should do it. I don't think that's the message. You know, every founder needs an incredible army, team of people in order to achieve anything. And so people are able to also play incredible contribution roles as part of that too. So, you know, it's working out, you know, which part you want to play. But I think the good news is that you can play any part you want if you really want to play it.
It's so true, and I think this is part of the risk that people see, especially in the online sphere around, you know, people who come in, whether it be a sales guru or a marketing guru, and they, you know, it's like, this is the formula. You know, follow these steps for success. And I think it's an important takeaway what you're sharing there is like, there are so many different ways to skin the cat. There are so many different individualities and unique, you know, traits. As long as you've got the, you know, the consistency, the persistency, you know, dreaming big and all that, those are those key things you need to have in order to play big.
Yeah, and usually the playbook from one place doesn't just translate to another. You still usually have to roll your sleeves up and figure it out. Even an SEO playbook, you can take it from one company. You've still got to go and figure out who are these people that are going to buy this, who are searching for it online, what are they wanting and feeling. What's the problem? Where do they live? Where do they work? You know, all these kind of things. You still got to figure all that out if you really want to speak to them and strike a nerve. So, yeah, I've met plenty of people who are kind of shopping playbooks around, and we tend to avoid them. But I've seen some amazing examples, especially in San Francisco. I saw a CMO, let's say, from a company that everyone listening would probably know, had been there just for 18 months. Met them in a coffee shop for an hour for a job interview for a CMO role with us. Sounded like they pretty much created this company. And then I'm tempted to say the name of it, but I won't. And then met the team for a couple of hours, and then I did some reference checks and it didn't sound good. They'd wasted a big budget. So when I told them that you know, we weren't going to go ahead, they said, well, I pretty much gave you the secrets to this company. So, yeah, how about we just make it a neat $50,000 for my time? Like, this is the stuff that's going on out there. And, like, this person had spent, like, 3 hours with us interviewing for a job, and then when didn't get it, sent an invoice.
Oh.
And I sent it to Scott Farquhar, and we had a laugh about it. But I never responded to it, and they never followed it up because it was a joke. But this is the kind of stuff where people are saying, I was part of this company, therefore I'm amazing. When it was often a combination of a whole lot of factors. It was a great product. It was a great team, you know, and together they worked on it. And the other thing is, it takes time to do anything well. Anyone that's hopped around 2 years here, 2.5 here, 18 months here, they haven't done anything yet. You know, in 2 years, they spent the first 6 months, you know, working out where the lunchroom is and everything else. They, you know, they spent another maybe year working on the problem, and then they started thinking about their exit or realized they were no good and they were gone again. And so, and then they update their LinkedIn profile about 8 months after that to make it look like it's been a bit longer. Like, these games have all been played now. So it's like you actually have to do something well and do it long enough to be able to do it well. So, you know, we genuinely look for people who've spent, you know, 5 years focused on a problem and doing it really well. And often they'll, you know, get pulled into another role, and that's a good sign. But yeah, just shopping playbooks around or trying to say, well, you know, I did this in the last job, so I'll be able to do it here. you kind of have to go a bit deeper than that and really understand what the problem is, who is solving it for, and what's the best way to go about it.
And with that, when I think about that around the tenure, what does that look like inside safety culture? Like, is there an average time span that you're finding with all your team members?
Yeah, well, we were in Sydney. We opened in Sydney in 2016, and we went from 30-odd people to 75 within about 18 months, 2 years. And so I'd say back then, if you were doubling every year on the brink of things breaking, so we were doing more than that. And then just to throw extra fuel on, we went from 75 people to 320 in 18 months. And that's chaos.
That's chaos.
So I don't recommend anyone do that.
No one knows where the lunchroom is. They're all freaking out.
Exactly. And so it's taken us a while. I think the team that we have today, probably since sort of 2020 COVID period onwards, that team is very different to the team we had before. And the people who are on the team today, they've evolved and they're a very different person to what they were. So it's a different experience. But I think we're seeing more people now, like some people have hit 10 years and things like that, which is I guess, unusual in tech. Mm. But they're also people that deeply understand what they're here to do and have had a big impact, which is great to see.
And as a business, the takeaway there, how would a leader, a business owner, think about creating those long-spanning tenures? Is there anything you're doing, not to get into your playbook, but is there anything there that you think is fundamental to be able to keep someone engaged for that kind of time?
I think customer centricity has to be the key to what you do. Mm. If people are here every day thinking about the customers, and I push everyone in the company has an open ticket to go and visit a customer. And it's funny, not enough people do. Mm. I constantly have to say, when did you last visit a customer? When did you go and see what they're doing? And I think if you are close to the problem and you understand it, I took an engineer out to see a fire department recently and the fire department was showing us how they check all of their lockers on the fire truck. So there's like 10 or 11 lockers and they check them all with safety culture. And we're talking about RFID. One of the engineers said, RFID would be great. And I was like, that would be amazing, where we could just automatically get all the info off, the breathing apparatus and stuff. And so I said to the engineer, well, why don't you build that for him? He's like, I'm not really on that assets team. I'm like, well, you are now.
Yes.
So figure it out kind of thing. And so I think if you can, get smart people in front of the problem and they understand, particularly if it has a human impact, they feel, hey, I want to do something about this. And so it gets much easier for people to stay engaged and motivated if you keep them close to that. And then bring people in as well. We had Caleb Holloway, who was on the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico that caught fire in 2010. There was 11 people died in the drill shack and he was the 12th person. He was the only person that survived in the actual drill shack.
Wow.
So 140 got rescued off the rest of the rig. But we played the movie that Mark Wahlberg's in and at the end of it, then Caleb walks in and never been out of America. We've flown him out from Texas. He didn't charge us anything to come other than pay for his flights. And he asked if his friend could come with him because he'd never been outside the US. Sure. And so Caleb came and told his story. And, people, I think, will remember that forever. And every year we bring all our staff together for a week. And this year we're in New Zealand. And so we'll probably have some surprise for some of the team that's similar to connecting them to why this matters. But there's a human side to what we do. So we're a bit fortunate in that sense that we get to see the real impact on people.
That's cool. And it'd be silly for me not to ask, when was the last time you saw a customer?
Last week.
Love
that. Out on a site visit. So, I'm constantly, even when I go to a Coles service station to fill my car up a couple of weeks ago, as I was about to walk out, I saw the attendant grab an iPad. And I said, can I just ask, what do you do with the iPad? He said, we go and check all our fridges and put temperatures in and all that. I said, what do you use that? He goes, it's safety culture. I'm like, cool. I'm just left. But I'm always looking and seeing, where people use us.
That's so cool. Yeah. So one of the topics I mostly avoid, but it feels so important in today's discussion, where safety culture is. And the reason I avoid it is just because most people ask the question. I'm leading on here, but it's around AI. And I guess the changes and the changing of the landscape. And so many people have this conversation, but I feel like you're very well placed given where you are in the world, the scale of your business and the tech. How do you think of that evolving, one, your business, but beyond that as well?
Yeah, look, AI is not a new thing, right? Mm-hmm. There's a new take on it at the moment, but it's not a new thing. And so there's been forms of artificial intelligence for decades. So I think that's the first thing is that it's not like it's some crazy new thing. It's just had a step change in terms of the language models now and what can be done with them and things like that. But in our business, we allow people to be able to create an inspection checklist using AI. They can say, you know, I'm a restaurant in New York City and I want a daily opening checklist and I have sidewalk dining and it's going to do a pretty good job and look at all local regulations and things like that. There's just daily checklist. Or if you want to train a team member on how to, you know, I guess make a perfect Subway sandwich in a Subway store, it'll take everything that's out there about how to make a great Subway sandwich and turn it into a 5-minute induction course, whatever you want. So we have all that today. We've got 3.5 petabytes of data, 2.5 billion images, and we're starting to do more with that for our customers where they can find the most relevant information to them if they've, you know, running a massive team and they want to see what photos have been taken of, you know, rotten fruit in supermarkets or whatever, then we can help them find that sort of thing. So we can expedite the process of finding the most relevant information. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff we've got to automate some of the manual things that we do. But I think AI will continue to evolve. The automation of manual tasks is really what's changing, I think, as faster than ever. And so when we think about that, we need to become a robotics and an AI business over the next decade from our point of view. Our customers that go out and physically do things, even people who want clean windows, and now you can have a robot that'll clean windows and they don't always come in the form you think, but you know, Uber drivers are being replaced now in the US with, you know, driverless vehicles. You're seeing that in San Francisco and some of the other places. That was kind of Uber's model from the beginning. The day they have to stop paying their 25-30% commission to drivers, then they've got a very profitable business. And so it's coming. And I think what we and everyone needs to think about is what are the jobs that are easiest to automate, and how do we then free ourselves up to solve the problems that we haven't yet figured out? And that brings us into, you know, productivity. You know, over the years, was probably go back 100 years, the average person would have worked 6 days a week. Now it's 5. If you're, you know, Gen Z or whatever, it's probably 2.5 or 3. But I think it's inevitable that you'll see like a 4-day work week come and beyond. And so that's great in one sense. We perhaps have more time for family and things like that. The big question I have as we move towards that is, what do people do for a sense of purpose? Because a lot of their self-esteem, self-worth, their purpose comes from their work. And so we've got to figure out how we tweak that over time and still make sure that people are fulfilled and able to feel like they're contributing in a meaningful way.
Do you think, you know, I guess there's a question around, the debate is, do you believe that people would be as productive in that 4-day environment or more so? Like, where do you sit on that?
Well, I think through technology, humanity has become way more productive. The things that we can do today in a split second compared to manual tasks of the past, whether it be manufacturing lines. You know, Australia, for example, had a big disadvantage with our labour costs for many years with manufacturing, and it went offshore. Today, most manufacturing in big plants can be done through robotics, so no longer is that a problem. We have other issues like the high cost of energy and things like that that needs to be sorted out. But, I think... what was the question?
Do you believe the argument, which is we will be equally as productive in those 4 days?
Yeah, so we continue to become more productive as a society. So I think we'll be more productive over time in 4 days than what we are in 5. You know, a doctor can now use AI to read x-rays and every student will have a tutor available to them 24 hours a day and no question will ever be a dumb question. And so I think, we're constantly improving the quality of our lives and becoming more productive over time. So that's only going to continue to accelerate.
And one of the things I noticed as I walked in today into this building here in Surry Hills... It's epic. It's a really special place. So we're sitting up here in the al fresco, open door area downstairs. It's a huge kitchen, and the place has a vibe about it. Like, What was your thinking behind the why you've created such a special place? And I guess a follow-on to that is, like, what is the kind of culture that you're creating here at, as a business?
Well, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but on each floor there's themed meeting rooms that are themed around our customers' businesses. And so people think we did that for our customers, but that's not why I did it. I did it for our teams to know who we're doing this for, who we're coming to work for every day. And so if anyone looks online, there's photos of them and stuff, but you know, when I said to the team, you know, like, let's build a room around Cathay Pacific, you know, I think initially they sort of came back with a photo of an airplane to put on the wall. I'm like, no, we're actually going to build an airplane, like the inside of it.
We stopped on a level and I looked out and I was like, where are we? I thought maybe it was a different organisation. It looked like we were sitting inside an airplane or maybe like a train.
A train?
Yeah,
there's a train one as well. These are all our customers that we do this for. So when, you know, someone joins a company, they may not have spent years out in industry. And so I think we need to make sure that we remind them every day about why we're here doing this, who we're doing it for. And so this building has been built around those experiences to connect people to the problem and also to create a space that, you know, is multi-purpose. People can socialise. It could feel like you're at a bar or you could also be, you know, in a really fun meeting room. One of our meeting rooms looks like a daycare centre, but it's actually Good Start Early Learning. You know, they had a child in a van tragically killed up in Cairns because they accidentally left them in the car and they were asleep and they got overheated. They then rolled out safety culture everywhere. And so we have a meeting room, which is Good Start Early Learning. Wow. And it's a really fun daycare kind of vibe, but there's a real story behind why that is there. And so I think it comes back to, again, emotionally connecting people to the why behind what you do. And this building is a reflection of that.
There is a really strong, obviously, as you shared that story, my heart absolutely exploded. But there's a really strong element here that I think is for everybody, beyond just being at this scale. And that's the ability to create connective tissue between the team members and the true problems we're solving. And, you know, if I didn't get to the sense of what you just shared, and you think about an engineer or someone who's solving tickets in customer service, or you know, every different parallel in the business, truly understanding what the implication is, and I guess that emotional connection, that's a really powerful thing. And you know, it's similar to our business, I found the experience for people when they were longer there and they had the time with customer, it makes a bigger impact to the why. So I think that's a really special and something that I can see would have really a powerful way where, let's say, you ask one of your team members at a barbecue, you know, what is it you do? It's not just, we create a checklist. It's, hey, like, we are making those kinds of issues not happen again.
It's funny you say talking to people at a barbecue, because that has been said to me by our own team members so many times. And they say, when I'm at a barbecue and someone says, what do you do? I'm proud to say what I do, and I start telling them all about it. And I've suffered from that as well. I've talked too much, at times. You know, I remember in the early days are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I'll tell you a story. But we're in the Qantas lounge on our way back from visiting our customers right in the beginning. I think we must have snuck in there somehow, because we still would have been like bronze status or something. But started chatting to this guy who worked from equipment hire company, and I was like, wow, you should use this checklist app. And away I went for about 5 minutes, and the guy just stopped and said, can you just fuck off? And I just went, oh my God, I died. And I left and I said to Al, I said, that guy didn't want to hear it, did he? And I didn't realize. And so, you know, I think to have something though that you're that passionate about is a really cool thing. And hopefully my sensory acuity is a little bit higher these days and I don't bombard people with that level of passion. But it's a cool thing, and we generally get excited about it. It's, you know, when people think about workplace safety and quality, it's probably not like pillow talk to their significant other at the end of the day for most people, but we seem to make it fun and sexy. Yeah. It was funny. I met someone recently, and it was a friend of a friend, and there was like four people at a pub, and they asked what I did, and I said, oh, you know, we do best practice, and you know, it's kind of the opposite. They asked me about compliance, and I said, oh, it's really not really compliance. It's way beyond that. Compliance is kind of a minimum standard. And then when I asked, you know, what is it you do, which I probably should have asked at the start, they said they were an industrial relations commissioner for workplace health and safety. And I went, oh, well, shit, I've just been bagging out everything. They're like, no, it's fine, we get it. We think it's good. But I think we're very lucky that we are in a business that is actually fun for us.
Amazing. I have two more questions for you, Luke, if that's okay.
Sure.
So one of them is a selfish one. So each time I like to ask a guest, based on their series of expertise, a question around the cookbook Eat With Purpose and how to best solve the challenge that I have in front of me. Now, the challenge I have is I am directly selling the product once it launches in October, and the goal is $1 million, 100% of the revenue goes to charity. And so if I look at the incredible business that you've built through, not having sales team members, but I guess through marketing, through word of mouth, how would you think to go about that problem solve when it comes to launching the cookbook?
I just as off the top of my head, I've had no time to think about it, but I would probably try and find other people who have an audience that you could partner with and help promote it. I can remember I met a guy in the US who he went and basically bought a whole bunch of stuff from a $2 shop to work out what would sell online, and he put it all online. The thing that sold was teenage girls' makeup. And so he went and ended up going to a factory in China and getting them to make pretty much the same stuff that you see in Sephora. And he started selling this online, and he would go to YouTubers and get them to review the product and give them a clip on it. And they would sometimes do 120 grand in a day in sales. And, these were other 14-year-old girls, and they would get a clip on that. So I'm probably giving a whole lot of people some ideas. But, if someone has an audience and you can partner with them, I think collab is what the cool kids call it, then you can get out to a lot more people. That's one idea. I think the other one is sort of what you're doing now, but telling the story around a brand or a product is really important, the narrative. And telling a compelling story that other people will retell. Like I'm going to go and say, oh, yeah, I know Frank, he's doing a cookbook. I don't even know what's in the cookbook, but I still feel I should buy it because I think it's for a good cause and a good reason and there's a good story behind it. So I think, having a good story around a product and then being able to amplify it is really powerful. And then it's understanding who your market is. How do you get it in front of the people who are going to want it at the right time? Dare Jennings, I met, he started Mambo with Reg Mombasa, and he then also started Deus Ex Machina, that they see the Deus brand around everywhere. And he was telling me about how when they started it, it was a fashion label to give surfers an identity off the water. When they're on the water, they're part of this kind of culture. When you're off the water, unless you're carrying a surfboard, you don't recognize each other necessarily. And so the original Mambo poo shooter, shirt and stuff that they had and all the apparel that came with it, that was about giving them an identity and knowing who the market was. And he's done it again with Deus, where 40-something-year-olds who worked in office during the week, wanted to be cool on a Saturday morning and ride little bucket races up to the coffee shop and then buy a cap. And, it was a fashion play. And so I think understanding who your market is and then being able to speak to them and reach them is really key.
I love that. Not just one, but three. Thank you, Luke. I appreciate that. I have one last question for you. Now, I know we're not at the conclusion of safety culture, and the way I feel today is we're halfway through writing the story.
We're about 5% of that.
Even better. Yeah. But as we reflect and look back, what are you most proud of?
I'll give you two examples. One is when I got a photo from one of our staff members hugging their family and their children, and they said, we're hugging them because we just told them that mum and dad have paid off their house thanks to safety culture, their equity and safety culture, and they'll never owe the bank any money again. And, when I hear that and people who are able to have an extra child in their family and one parent can stay home longer and things like that because their equity had grown to a point where it was now life-changing for them, I think that's really special. The other example is I got a phone call from a customer in Canada. And they rang and he said, I just want to tell you this story. He said, my wife and I have two adult disabled children that are now in their early 20s. And we have had a really rough ride for the last two decades or so. And he started crying. He's really emotional. And he said, For the last 5 years, though, I've been the safety culture champion in my workplace. And this is the first time in the last 20 plus years that I've felt I've had any purpose. And it's thanks to what you've done that's given me that. And I just want to ring you and tell you. And so, you know, that keeps me going.
Wow. Yeah. How did that feel getting that call?
Amazing. I never forget it. And, you know, we hear this. We see people win innovation awards because they rolled out safety culture at the workplace. These are everyday people. These aren't even IT people. Mm. These are just frontline people who are, you know, responsible for a small team or doing what they do. And that's really rewarding. And I know from all the 2,500 claims that I saw as a private investigator and a manager of investigators, that the toll when things go wrong is significant for people. And so we don't know when it goes right. No one rings you up and tells you that, hey, we nearly died but didn't today. And so I think there's just some satisfaction in knowing that the world's a better place for what we do. People go home to their families every day. And the majority of our customers work in a safe environment, but they get to improve what they do every day. And you know, innately, no one goes to work and wants to do a bad job. So if we can help them be better at what they do, then that's worth getting out of bed for.
Luke, I absolutely love it. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Frank.